right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce, as always, joined by my notorious compadre, Mr. Brendan Veman. How are you doing, Brendan?
I am doing great, Bryce. Doing great.
How graceful.
It's graceful and great. It's just a great day overall. Markets are at all-time highs. We're happy over here in the great world of blockchain.
Yes, volatility starting to creep back into the markets. Seeing big swings up, maybe seeing some big swings down. But regardless, this show is not about the day-to-day price action. It is about the foundation of this industry, the people who are building, people who are not scared away by the volatility, people who are here, rain or shine. You see, I got my winter coat on. It's raining in San Diego, one of those rare days. But we are joined by Paul Frambeau, who is the builder and the CEO and the founder of Morpho Labs. And he's joining us today to talk about all things DeFi. Paul, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing awesome. Thank you for having me today.
Have you ever wanted to trade Bitcoin but haven't dared tried? With Plus 500 Futures, you can trade crypto without the hassle of opening a wallet. With just a few clicks, you can register and start practicing with their free and unlimited demo. See a trading opportunity? You'll be able to trade in just two clicks. Feel ready? You can move to real money with as little as $100 once your account is approved. And the great thing is that in addition to crypto, Plus 500 gives you access to a wide range of instruments like the S&P 500, NASDAQ, gas, and much more. Explore equity indices like energy, metals, Forex, and beyond. With a simple and intuitive platform, you can trade anytime, anywhere. Experience the fast, accessible futures trading you've been waiting for with Plus 500. With over 20 years of experience, Plus 500 is your gateway to the markets. Visit us.plus500.com to learn more. Trading in futures involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify, and this is not personal financial advice. Plus 500, it's trading with a plus.
Yeah, we're really excited, and there's a lot to talk about. And we always kind of like to start with just a little background, just to get acquainted, you and I, with the audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself, what you were doing before you founded Morpho Labs.
So actually, I was not doing much. I was just at university. I don't have a professional background before diving into DeFi. I was studying distributed and parallel systems in Polytechnique in Paris. And from there, I studied like blockchain, consensus technology, and, you know, distributed algorithms. And this is how this was my way into like the blockchain space and the DeFi space. And at the same time, I was really into entrepreneurship and had a couple of business running at the time, but nothing, you know, was too really explosive. And at some point, I decided to, you know, regroup the two and started getting interested into DeFi and especially how we can, you know, how blockchain in general can help fundamental problems in the financial system and the financial infrastructure of today. And I have a long history of hate against the existing traditional financial system. I could never see myself working in finance before I got introduced to the blockchain technology. And this is only when I sort of like understood the promise and you know the capabilities of the blockchain protocols that I was able to sort of like get myself to work into DeFi, because I knew it was going to cure all the problems that we have today in today's financial infrastructure.
Yeah, I love it. And so just to be clear, you were like going to university for computer science. You're like programming. Is that right?
I said parallel and distributed systems, which is a field of computer science, especially useful in layer one technologies.
Got it. And I know the French have a famous history of naturally just distrusting institutions and governments and all that kind of stuff. So you applied all of your computer science to rebuilding the future of finance. And I'm curious, you know, what was it that kind of got you to? Did you drop out or did you finish?
Right. So that's a question I get asked all the time, because in the US you have sort of like this dropout student meme that's very famous. I don't know if it's actually, you know, happening in real a lot of times, but yeah, in France we don't have this at all, right? So I did raise funds twice during my studies, the first 1 million rounds in 2021 in my second year. And then I raised 20 million with Andreessen Horowitz and Invariant in my third year. And I did not drop out. I finished my school. And, you know, started building the company at the same time. There was some crazy times. And, you know, the four co-founders were students, right? So we finished all together. And at the same time, started, you know, hiring a lot of people in the team. So that was some quite fun time, I have to say. But then we finally ended up finishing school. And this is where, you know, we accelerated a lot on Morpho.
Yeah, I think America has this infatuation with dropping out because we all watch The Social Network with Mark Zuckerberg, and everybody hears about, you know, Bill Gates dropping out of Harvard, and so we're like, yeah, stick it to the man. But it's maybe not a globally shared feeling.
What I love about this is that the next generation of finance is being built by the next generation of humans here. I mean, you're young, you're in school, you're doing all this just as like a research project at your university. And here you are saying, hey, there are changes that can be made to better finance as a whole through making a bit more decentralized. And here we are. And Bryce, I have a feeling that we're going to see more of this kind of moving forward with the next generation of finance, the next generation of AI, the next generation of you fill in the blank being built by the next generation, which is generally a younger one. The people who are in college, you know, maybe in high school, maybe just fresh out of university, they're saying, hey, we see these problems and they don't have to be this way. And I think that's really cool. You know, we don't have, I mean, in some cases, right, we have 60, 70, 80 year olds building stuff. But here is a great example where anyone can come into the space. They can see the problem, offer a solution, and build on it from there. So
right.
I think that's super fascinating.
And also, I would also add to this that, you know, younger founders bring a ton of innocence and they have no sort of like bias. And like when we came into DeFi, like I had no idea how the financial world, you know, was working. And I guess having zero experience and zero bias had us, you know, think about things really differently. And you could tell in DeFi who's coming from a financial background and who's coming from a computer science background, depending on how they're designing their protocol, right? You could tell exactly who's a computer scientist, who's trying to do a complex quantitative financial product on chain, right? Anyway.
Very interesting. And, you know, what kind of got you to start Morpho? Because I say this question from the standpoint of you're a computer scientist. There's lots of problems in crypto that you could be solving, building solutions. What made you narrow in on this one design, this one idea?
Right. So I guess a few things. We have this overall thesis at Morpho that's computer science and computer networking is not so far away from finance. And it's just a matter of, like, you know, manipulating data through protocols. It's just that data now is valuable and can be owned thanks to the blockchain technology. That's like the, you know, more longer term, you know, thinking about this. But, you know, obviously I was not thinking about those abstractions 2.5 years ago when starting Morpho. And really what got us into building this was, I'd say, you know, the permissionless aspect of Ethereum, like having the EVM completely open, and we could, you know, look at existing lending protocols, look at their design entirely. We could learn from them. You had a ton of documents. Everything was open. All the documentation was open. If you try to learn about traditional finance lending markets, it's very hard. Like no one, you know, tells you about how they work. It's you really have to know the people that know the person that worked into the company that made the financial offer. Otherwise, there's no way for you to truly understand how they're working out, you know, some of those problems. Here, it was like completely open, so I could learn a lot. And you know, by learning, you know, and you start having models about, you know, how Uniswap is working, how Aave, Compound, Maker is working. And from there, you start asking yourself, what can we do better? And you know, I had this research think tank at the time where we came up with a bunch of different ideas. One of them was a Salami swap, which was essentially Uniswap B3 before Uniswap B3, which just the idea of like, you know, the little tranches of price. And another one was Morpho. And essentially looking at Compound and Aave's protocol, you could see that there was a significant inefficiency between the lending and the borrowing rate. And this is where, you know, we sort of, it sparked the idea that we could potentially build something that optimized for this spread, right? So there is like the lending rate, the borrowing rate, a large gap between the two. Maybe we can build something that enables users to get the mid rate, right? And so this is what we did, essentially.
No, I think that's great, man. I mean, again, spotting the flaw of like, hey, there's this difference here between the lending rate and the borrowing rate, and kind of coming to that solution. Like, did you have any kind of background in finance before you studied that? Because like that's you have to have an eye to spot that kind of problem. So was it just you digging around in the code, and was it just your like computer scientist side coming out, or was there something else there that helped you like spot that problem?
So yeah, no, we had zero experience at the time in finance. And you know, at the end of the day, the good thing about smart contracts is that it all comes down to math, and you know, so those are things we sort of like understood and that we could play out with. And what's interesting about the way Morpho has been designed is that it's really esoteric compared to other lending and DeFi protocols, just because like we just the idea that we were going to build on top of an existing lending platform in order to optimize for the spreads is something you could not even think of in the traditional finance world, just because if you were to do this in the traditional finance world, well, you know, there is a risk that the lending platform cuts the API, right? And you can't operate anymore. Here it's like open composable API thanks to the Ethereum. And so this first like was something you could not even think about. And the way the mechanism was built in Morpho Optimizer, without getting into the technical details, really goes deep into integrating Aave and Compound and interacting with them in a way that's never have been possible in traditional finance. Like it's really like the two algorithms are in symbiosis with one another. In a way you could never imagine to be the case in TradFi.
Yeah, and enter Morpho, right? I mean, you're claiming to basically just trying to make this new era of lending where it's more secure, it's more efficient, it's more flexible. So walk us through, I guess, how you're doing that, how you're making this next generation of lending protocol.
Right. So we in our history, we had two protocols. The first protocol is Morpho Optimizer, and the second protocol is Morpho. So Morpho Optimizer is this protocol living on top of Aave and Compound that's optimizing their interest rate. So we've been doing this for 2 years. It grew, I think today is like over $2 billion of deposits into it, which is quite massive. And the thing is that with this model is that it's not scalable. It's not scalable because it's built on top of Aave and Compound, but also it inherits from the Aave and Compound protocol, which are limited, right? And this is what we decided to sort of go away from this model to build something completely different and rebuild decentralized lending, bottoms up. And by building what we call Morpho Blue, which is a completely new independent lending protocol that is completely immutable and much, much simpler than existing lending protocols. So essentially the general idea is that existing lending pools and just DeFi 1.0 in general are on-chain funds. So it's large pools of capital that are managed by token holders. So essentially when you go to Aave or when you go to Compound or a bunch of other lending pools, you just deposit your money. You don't get to do anything. And they're going to do the complex risk management for you, the complex smart contract upgrade for you, the features and UX management, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the approach of Morpho Blue is that we think that on-chain funds are great but are not scalable, in the sense that if you want to tackle more and more use case, list more and more collateral, you have to complexify this fund for everybody, right? It's a kind of like a one-size-fits-all approach for the entire world. So if you have some USDC and you want to earn yield on them, there is only one option, which is like Aave with one risk profile, which is extremely complex. And we think that this model will not scale to transform finance, right? Like the true traditional financial infrastructure. And so this is why we were like, okay, we're going to separate the risk management components from the protocol. So we're just going to keep the lending and borrowing engine. So it's a tiny piece of code, 600 lines compared to Aave, which is like 7,000 lines of code. So we keep only the lending and borrowing protocol engine. And on top, we rebuild those on-chain funds, right, on top of it. And this way, we have a common ground, which aggregates all the state, all the liquidity, which is the Morpho Glue lending and borrowing protocol. And then on top, you have vaults that are run by risk experts that can express any risk profile, any compliance profile to everybody in the world, right? And so yeah, having a trustless and efficient core primitive that's extremely simple, on top of which you rebuild the experience you want with the risk you want, with the compliance you want, is for us the only way to scale DeFi to the masses.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the last cycle, there were quite some blow-ups. And it wasn't just blow-ups of centralized institutions like BlockFi, Voyager, Celsius, FTX. There was also blow-ups of DeFi protocols, namely, you know, Ohm was one that kind of blew up and was at $1,000 and went all the way down to like, what, $5? Luna, which was like $100 and went down to fractions of a fraction of a fraction of a penny. There were many, many such examples. What did they get wrong? And not to just throw those two under the bus, but in general, what did the DeFi protocols of last cycle that blew up, you know, what did they get wrong?
All right. So I think the idea is that if we want to scale DeFi, which everybody has been trying for the last 5 years, we want to be tackling more use cases, more experiences for different, you know, users. So in practice, that means enabling, you know, leverage on more assets, or, you know, enabling a wider diversity of, you know, asset that you can borrow, that you can use as collateral. And the way to go so far has been, we're going to enshrine all this complexity. Every time there's a new use case, we're going to upgrade the protocol, add more complexity in the main instance in order to be able to tackle all those different use cases. And I think this approach, you know, makes sense, but trades with security, right? What you're referring to is that, you know, protocols are trying to do everything at the same time in one single smart contract, but obviously, you know, smart contract development is risky and you know, turns out to have either smart contract hacks or economic hacks, right? And as you said, we witnessed in 2022, 2023, a lot of different hacks. And I think the majority of them were avoided, you know, through white hat, etc. But it just proves that we're orders of magnitude away in terms of like security compared to what we should expect from the financial infrastructure of the future, right? Just to us, the fact that you have a protocol that is upgradable to be able to fix bugs is just a sign in itself that you're not a reliable enough financial infrastructure for trillions of millions of trillions of dollars, essentially. So I guess that was the mistake that we made. I mean, the mistake was not a big, you know, mistake. We're just learning. But so I guess the solution, the cure to this is essentially, okay, let's not try to do everything at the same time. Let's do much less. And let's be expressive enough such that anyone can build everything on top, right? And so maybe on the different, you know, vaults that are built on top of Morpho, maybe one of them will break, you know, at some point because the risk management has not been done properly. But at least the infrastructure remains forever the safe and, you know, efficient, completely trustless, like a core primitive, right? So yeah, that's our approach. And I like to frame it as DeFi is moving from being an app to an infrastructure on top of which you can build different apps on chain.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I also see everyone throwing around this newer term, DeFi 2.0, right? Everyone's liking to talk about it. And you kind of alluded to it, right? Saying, hey, how can we learn from our past mistakes and make DeFi something that learns from those and just ultimately comes out with a better product that can service the whole world. And so just walk us through from like your perspective, like what is DeFi 2.0? And I also saw you talking about this actually in, I think it was an article, but you were talking about how you think that it will define the upcoming bull market. So I would just love to hear your thoughts on like, I guess, what has changed between DeFi 1.0 and 2.0 and why you're so optimistic about it.
Right. So I think people introduced DeFi 2.0 for the first time in 2022 when introducing the super risky products narrative. And then, you know, very quickly in the months after, you know, you had a bunch of hacks and scams. So people are okay. We're like, let's forget about DeFi 2.0. We're going to use this term for later. And I think now is a good time to use it. And I think that's definitely the paradigm shift of moving, you know, DeFi protocols from being great apps into DeFi protocols being great infrastructure. And you could tell this is what Uniswap and Maker have gone through, for example. If you look at the Uniswap roadmap, Uniswap V2 is a great product. Like you can use it directly on chain. You deposit your money, it's going to generate you some cash. You don't have to manage it at all, both for traders and for LPs. Uniswap V3 is for traders, super simple, great product. For LPs, you know, you have to do some market making. I would not dare using the front end of Uniswap V3 to supply some liquidity. Probably, you know, won't generate any profit because of all the complexity of users and market makers. And Uniswap V4 is going even further. It's just like as a trader, you have to select which pool you're going to trade on, right? As an LP, you have to do your essentially, you know, select which hook are convenient for you and then the range, etc. And clearly here, the users that are interacting with Uniswap V4 are not the same casual users that were interacting with Uniswap V2. And Uniswap V4 is transforming itself in an infrastructure on top of which anyone can build their own DEX, on top of anyone, you know, developers will be interacting, not end users, right? And only with all the different products that are built on top. So for example, Uniswap X was built on top of Uniswap before. Is going to enable a great product right on top. So yeah, I guess I would define 2.0 as transitioning DeFi protocols from being great products into great protocols on top of which new products are built.
So do you think that the existing DeFi 1.0 protocols can adapt and evolve into DeFi 2.0 protocols? Or do you think that it has to be new projects entirely getting created and entering into the space?
Right. So
like things like, you know, you mentioned Maker. I know Maker has some big upcoming plans to do a split and update tokenomics. Do you think that they can go through those kind of changes and now enter into the world of DeFi 2.0?
So I guess, you know, you have essentially two outcomes. It's just like, it's kind of the innovator dilemma as well. Like, you know, you're in a comfortable position where you make a lot of cash with your existing product. And, you know, there is a bigger, even bigger opportunity. Either you renounce or you're on your existing model that's, you know, making you so much money to try to get to something even bigger. And, you know, I think this is what Maker is doing with Maker Endgame. It's like it's a very ambitious plan, and I think it makes a ton of sense to sort of like remove the complexity from the core protocol, become a pure infrastructure on top of which you'll have different sub-DAOs. And I think some DAOs will succeed, even though it's very difficult when you're decentralized to have such a pivot in your strategy. But I think it's mostly going to come through disruption, you know, like, you know, new projects like ours that, you know, have the chance and the flexibility of being able to build from scratch things that are in a state where, you know, you don't have all those heavy, very heavy governance process that have been in place for like the last 6 years. The protocol is like in the case of Morpho, like we're still a quite agile DAO, I would say, compared to other protocols that will have a much harder time to move faster, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I love it. And if we kind of take a step back away from the code, away from the specifics, if we just take a look at the ethos or the philosophy of DeFi, and I know you mentioned you know, discontent with the traditional financial institutions, I'm just wondering if you see DeFi ever being used by just the global population, the unbanked, folks who don't even have access to sort of the developed world's financial system. Do you see DeFi extending to all those people, or do you see it as just being a niche for DeFi traders and stuff like that?
So clearly currently it's a niche, right? Like, we have to be transparent about it. We, you know, it's a niche for high net worth individual, family offices, DeFi funds that are taking, you know, leverage or want to high yield on their tokens, etc. It's definitely not democratized enough in, you know, the broader market, as you describe. That said, I think structurally, blockchain technology and the permissionless nature of it will enable marketplaces and financial infrastructure on top of which permissionless financial products can be built. And those financial products will compete in the open for fees, will compete in the open for adoption. And this is where things get interesting, because it all comes down to being open. Because everything is open, the free market laws will operate in such a way that they can't operate in the traditional financial system infrastructure. And this will drive the fees down for everybody. And because it's permissionless, well, eventually, you know, if your fees are going down, you're going to look for like more distribution. And this is where we, you know, get into CeFi, fintechs, and eventually, you know, more, you know, probably targeting, you know, unbanked countries, etc., and eventually TradFi, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of different ways to go about this. You have, you know, the monolithic approach, which is kind of, maybe we could attribute that towards Solana, and then we have the modular protocols, things like Near Protocol. Even Ethereum with all of the layer twos. Which approach do you subscribe to? Which approach do you think will be able to house the future?
Right. So I think that's the hottest question, you know, of all the blockchain industry. Like, should it be layer twos on top of a shared neutral state machine, or should it be a efficient and, you know, one state machine, which is the Solana vision, you know, with probably layers eventually on top, but, you know, much less than Ethereum. And so a few things on this. I guess what I like about the Ethereum vision, like, the big upside that you get is the neutrality of the base layer. Like, you're decentralized in such a way, you can hope to be decentralized in such a way that probably won't be possible on Solana, just due to the infrastructure cost and, like, you know, of hosting nodes, etc. Then you have arguments against the current state of Ethereum, with like the distribution of the stake and you know, Ethereum stake that is not so well distributed, probably compared to Solana stake, and, you know, depends on how you count, etc. But I think eventually the approach of having a slow but sure base layer which aggregates the states, to me, seems appealing, just because of like the decentralization of it. And so I'd say that's one point for Ethereum. The downside, though, is that layer twos don't seem to be solving entirely the problems, right? Like, you still have fragmentation. You looks like we can have synchronicity between different layer twos, but I've never seen someone come up saying, hey, we can have like atomic transactions, you know, and share liquidity across different layer twos, which seems to be a big problem. Which Solana, on the other hand, is you know, sort of able to achieve, from my understanding. I'm not an expert on those topics, to be frank, but I think what's interesting about Solana is that, you know, they try to do as much as they can on one shared state. However, I don't believe in the one computer for the entire internet. I think that will require too much data, too much, you know, too many messages being broadcasted. I think they will have to have layers eventually. And, you know, probably the sexy vision is saying, hey, we'll have one global trust, you know, trustless like state machine. I'm really having a hard time thinking that's going to be the case, that the entire internet is going to be built on one distributed ledger. I think they'll have to have layers eventually. Yeah. Maybe fewer layers, but they will have to.
Well, I agree with you. You know, neither me nor Bryce subscribe to the whole maxi approach of it has to be just Bitcoin or just Ethereum, and it has to be just the main chains, and no one else is going to be able to succeed. You know, we live in a world where there's competitors in everything. You know, you look at Windows, you have Apple. You look at Walmart, you have Target. You look at Ford, you got Toyota, right? I mean, there's just competitors everywhere you look. And it, what that does is it constantly inspires just new innovation in the space, because that one group can't just relax and say, oh, you got high transaction fees, tough luck. You know, we're not going to update them because we got no competitors. Now, what we're seeing is that we have all these new protocols with really fast transaction speeds and all these new equipment and features. And so Ethereum's constantly updating itself. The big one that's coming up is the Dan Kuhn upgrade. I think it's in like a day or two from the time of recording this. And I mean, man, I love it. But Paul, you know, another thing that I was thinking about is you're just really plugged into the space when it comes to ETH DeFi as a whole. So is there anything that you're looking forward to this year?
Right. So Dan Kuhn is a big thing already, like, you know, just drastically increasing throughput at the layer two level. I think it's going to be incredibly exciting. I think it's going to probably change a lot of things in DeFi as well. I think a lot of the mechanism designs that were invented in DeFi work only for low throughput environments and high gas fees. And I'm expecting disruptions there. As soon as we go, you know, above a certain throughput threshold, I'm expecting new projects to come with like new designs. So the classic comparison is like, hey, order books versus automated market makers, right? But that's not the only thing that could happen. Like, you have a bunch of things, especially in the lending space, where we could see some disruption, and I'm super excited about this. So that's like the DeFi set of things. What we're, you know, obviously scalability is a great component. Now, account abstraction is even more interesting. Like, to me, we're on the verge of seeing more and more centralized application integrating decentralized, infrastructure in the back end, because they have this smart wallet infrastructure that abstracts away everything for the user. And the user won't even see it, right? But you know, when you look at all those fintechs, they have integrated, you know, wallets over the last 2 years. And I'm excited for them to join the party and bring, you know, organic order flow to Ethereum and just blockchains in general. And then the last thing I'm not expecting, but I hope we could have a bit more focus around is privacy. And, you know, we still live in a world where every financial transaction, like on Ethereum, where every financial transaction is out there in the public. And I just feel like there are probably some enhancements to be made here. So it's a less hot topic, to be frank. I'm not expecting major changes for 2024, but I'm not, you know, very deep in the topic. You know, probably will come from layer twos that have encryption in their, you know, in their stack, but we'll see from there. So yeah, I guess, you know, it's always around the three pillars, like scalability, account abstraction, and privacy always lagging behind a little bit.
Well, what about outside the DeFi sector? You know, we talked about DeFi a lot in today's episode, and rightfully so. But what's happening outside the world of DeFi that has caught your eye and you're interested in? I know there's a lot going on. We're seeing new verticals pop up left and right, which
I'm a big
fan of.
And please tell me it's not meme coins.
Yeah, so I guess the thing that people start to realize is the power of on-chain socials, which has been here around for I don't know how many years already, but I think, at least personally, I'm starting to get the full power of those like applications, and how, you know, they seem inevitable in for our future. And so obviously the rise of Farcaster has been quite impressive to me, and you know, we've been thinking around, you know, with the Morpho team, how we can, you know, reuse those on-chain social primitives, you know, in DeFi, but also in general in our personal life or professional life. And I think this, to me, like, just having the ability to own your social roots is something that has been truly interesting for me over the last like couple of months. I guess that's mostly it on my end, you know, what drives my attention in this space.
Yeah. And Farcaster is something that, you know, I think everybody who's listening should probably go check out, sign up. You know, it was funny. I was posting the other day about TikTok and how in America, people are, passing or not passing bills, but like suggesting bills to be passed that would ban TikTok. And, you know, this is based on potentially there being, you know, some Chinese spyware or whatever, backdoors and stuff in it. And you do see like, you know, people posting the feeds in China of like TikTok, you know, having educational uplifting stuff. And then here in America, it's like anxiety inducing, depression inducing craziness. But besides the point, you know, some people have built their livelihoods on this application. Some people have built marketing arms and, you know, complete business lines. And imagine, you know, with the stroke of a presidential pen, that business could be up in flames and completely eradicated. And it's just not entirely fair. And, you know, to have a platform like Farcaster, you know, you could trust that it's forever, right? The blockchain is forever and nobody could just ban it. Nobody could just, you know, censor it. And, you know, you don't need to go ask permission to use it. Anybody could use it and take your following with you. And you could own your audience. And I think, like you mentioned, I mean, this is a really, really big concept that we're just now starting to scratch the very tip of the iceberg on. And decentralized social media is going to be a huge, huge next big wave. Have you tried Lens before, made by the Aave?
Yeah, I've tried both. Like, I think Lens and Farcaster are both great. I'm just super excited by the ability to be able to have more trust in someone just because I know he can prove me his social graph, right? And I know this person does not have to reveal me his name or her name. It just has to show me, hey, here is my social graph. I'm trusted. I'm affiliated to this company. I can't be scamming you, right? And that's another, you know, very cool application because now you have this sort of like decentralized and privacy preserving trust signals directly from social graphs. I think it works slightly better with Lens currently because they've built the thing, you know, more on chain and this is, you know, their different value proposition, but I'm expecting Farcaster to go down that route as well eventually. I mean, super excited for those two different use cases. And as you mentioned, just the fact that you can own your following and own your personal brand or own your professional brand is super valuable. Like, I mean, we experienced problems with Twitter, like, you know, many people. We got our account banned. That we were in serious troubles because of this, right? So we know how that is. And usually you just realize it when you know, when something bad happens, right? Either you get banned or you lost your whatever, like, you know.
Totally.
So yeah.
Well, hey, Paul, this was incredible. And before we close things out here, as we're bumping up against time, I just want to know, where can people find out more? Where can people stay in touch with the community? Are you guys big on Discord, Telegram? You just mentioned Twitter. What are your handles? What are your sites? And how can we stay in touch?
Sure. So my Twitter is Paul Frambo, PaulFrambot. Same on Lens, same on Rapcaster. So if you're interested in those. Our social account for Morpho as a company is Morpho Labs, MORPHOLABS on Twitter. And our website is morpho.org.
Morpho.org. All right, everybody, check the show notes. And Paul, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.